For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is August the 22nd, and we are in Parashas Maaseh on page 928. And we are up to Pasuk Tes, verse 9. The last thing we discussed already several weeks ago, over a month ago, was the cities that were given by the rest of the tribes to the Levium. Since the Levium don't have their own portion in Eretz Yisrael, so each of the tribes gave some of their cities to the Levium. In that paragraph, the previous paragraph, there was a mention of the six cities of refuge. If you look back at the top of this page, 928, Pasuk Vav, verse 6, the very top of the page, the Pasuk says, Ve'eis ha'arim ha'shetitnu la'levi'im, and of the cities that you will give to the Levium, Eis Sheish Arei HaMiklat, the six cities of refuge, Asher Titnu Lanus Shama HaRotzeach, that you will give for the murderer to escape there, V'alehem Titnu Arbaim Ushtaim Ir, and in addition to those, you'll give another 42 cities, for a total of 48 cities to the Levium. So there's a mention there of cities of refuge for a murderer. No explanation there given for what type of murderer, under what circumstances. It's just that there are these cities of refuge, and we see from this verse that when we learn about the cities of refuge, which have not been mentioned yet, they will be cities of the Levium, which this is where you see that. Meaning, we're going to have a reference to the six cities of refuge in the paragraph we're about to learn tonight. It's not going to say anything about Levium. It's just going to say that you have cities of refuge. Here, in the previous paragraph, the one that we did last time, top of this page, there's a mention of Levium being in those cities. So they are cities of Levium. There is one other reference to cities of refuge in the Torah. Also, a passing reference way back in the Torah. I'm giving you an introduction because we're about to have an entire paragraph about the cities of refuge, many, many, many verses about it. But earlier in the Torah, we had a passing reference. So if you please hold the place here on page 928 and turn back all the way to Parashas Mishpatim, which is on page 420. On page 420, at the top of the page, Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12, the Pasuk says, Ma'ke'ish v'meis, mos yumas. If someone strikes someone and kills him, then that person, the murderer, is put to death. Capital punishment for murder. Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13, Va'asher lo tzada, but if he did not the way they translate here is he did not lay in ambush for him. The murderer did not lay in ambush for the victim. V'ha'elokim ina liyado, and God caused it to come into his hand. So it was not entirely the murderer's fault. Then, v'samti l'chama koma shayonus shama. I will give you a place where he will escape to. So we see here that the punishment for murder is capital punishment. However, there is a type of murder that does not warrant capital punishment. It's some sort of accidental murder. Perhaps negligent murder, but not premeditated murder. So for that, he would be given a place to escape to. Now, if he needs to escape, it means he has to run from something. The Torah here on page 420 in Parashas Mishpatim does not tell us what this person would be running from. Evidently, he needs to run. Run from what? That is not mentioned. So we see, we're given sort of like a few details, but those details are vague. There's two types of murder, one premeditated, one not. The one that's not, he has to escape. Escape from what? Doesn't tell us. Okay, turning back now to where we are on page 928. Again, at the top of the page, there's a passing reference to the six cities for the murderer to escape to. So again, we don't know what he's escaping from, but evidently it's the same reference as we had on page 420. For the murderer to escape to. So now we know that the place that Hashem is going to give you for the murderer to escape to, those are six of the cities of the Levium. So we're filling in pieces of the puzzle, but we're still missing a very great amount of information. We haven't clearly defined what type of murderer we're talking about. We don't know who he's escaping from. And what's the process of escape? All of this is still very vague. Now, where we start tonight in Pasuk Tes verse 9, we're going to get an entire paragraph to discuss it. Bear in mind that as much as we're going to get a lot of information, tonight and next week, because we're not going to finish this paragraph tonight, there's an entire another paragraph in the Torah later on in Parashas Shoftim, which we actually read in Shul 2 weeks ago. A whole nother paragraph about this. So the Torah spreads the information out around the Torah. It's not all located in one place. But we're going to get the bulk of the information tonight. So, Pasuk Tes verse 9, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemar, Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, Daber al b'nei Yisrael v'amarta alehem, speak to the Jewish people and say to them, Ki atem ovrim es hayardin arzo Kenan, when you cross the Jordan River into the land of Kenan, we are on page 928, when you cross the Jordan River into Kenan, v'hi krisem lachem arim, and you should designate for yourselves cities, arei miklat tihiena, tihiena lachem, they will be cities of refuge for you. Venas shamarotzeach, and the murderer will escape there. What type of murderer? Makei nefesh bishgaga. Someone who murders bishgaga. Now, what does the word shogeg mean? It translates it as unintentionally. In the language of the Chumash, we have three levels of intent. We have mazid, which means intentional, premeditated. We have shogeg, which they're translating as unintentional. And we have ones. Ones is without any blame whatsoever. Ones is what we would call an act of God. The person is blameless. That's ones. Shogeg is not intentional, it's unintentional, but it's not blameless. The person was what we would call negligent. So what's the classic case of the negligent person who commits murder? That is a case in the Chumash, not here, right, Sandy? Right, very good. So that's not here. It's not going to be discussed here. It's in Parsha Shoftim. That's the classic, the man in the forest who's chopping wood, and he neglected to make sure that the head of the axe was securely fastened to the handle of the axe. And as he strikes the wood, the axe head goes flying off, strikes somebody and kills him. So that's not premeditated murder. It's unintentional, but it's also not an act of God. The person was negligent. It's unintentional, but he's not blameless. So that's going to be the category for which the Torah is providing these cities of refuge. Now, we're describing three broad categories. Intentional, that's one extreme. Act of God, totally blameless, that's another extreme, ones. And then the middle ground, which is unintentional but not blameless. We'll call it negligent, shogeg. And that's the one for which there are cities of refuge. But there's going to be a bunch of gray, meaning a person can be more negligent and less negligent. And we're going to have to define exactly where does negligent begin and end, because at a certain point, we're going to move from negligent to blameless and from negligent to intentional. So where do you draw that line? How do you decide? For example, the Gemara discusses a case where a person intended to kill one person and accidentally killed another person. They missed the first person, but struck the second person. They didn't want to kill the second person. They feel bad that they killed the second person. They absolutely wanted to kill the first person. Is that intentional murder or unintentional murder? It's clearly not blameless, and it's more than negligence, but are we going to call that premeditated intentional murder? That is a gray area. Where are we going to go with that? What happens if you have a person who murders intentionally in cold blood, but was never warned? We know that typically, in order to punish, there has to be a warning. No warning was given. It's hard to say the person didn't know you're not allowed to murder. Most people know you're not allowed to murder. So that person, it was intentional murder. Do we put them to death? You can't say that that's unintentional. What about the other end of the spectrum? We just mentioned the case of the person is chopping wood and the axe head is not securely fastened to the axe handle. It goes flying off, strikes a person and kills him. Okay, that's negligent. That person needs to go to the Ir Miklat, to the city of refuge. What if it's not quite as negligent? What about a case, which is also discussed in the Gemara, where the person strikes the wood, the axe head does not come off of the axe handle, but a shard goes flying off of the wood that he strikes. That shard goes flying out, strikes someone and kills him. That's a little bit more detached from the one who's swinging the axe. Now, it's still coming because of an act that he did. Are we going to call that negligence? Or are we going to call that less than negligent? Where does that fit? Or what are we going to do with a case where a person is chopping wood in their own backyard? In their own backyard. And someone trespasses and walks onto their property who doesn't belong there. And the axe head flies off of the axe handle and hits that person and kills him. You'll say, there is a little bit of negligence there. I mean, he was not careful to make sure the axe head was securely fastened to the axe handle. On the other hand, what business does this person have in his property? So we get into gray areas. So we're describing broad categories, but it's not so simple what box you put each case into. Of course, there's a lot of Gemara about it, and we're not going to be able to cover every single case, but we're going to try to give some parameters for where things belong. But we know that the consequences for the various categories, premeditated murder, intentional murder, that's the death penalty, blameless, then ones, then nothing, and shogeg, unintentional but not blameless, negligent, that's where we're going to have the six cities of refuge. Okay. So, we said that he's going to have to run, escape to the city of refuge, but we didn't say what he's escaping from. Why is he escaping? So the Pasuk tells us, Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12, V'ayu lachem ha'arim lemiklat mi go'el, and the cities will be a refuge from the go'el. Now, a go'el literally means a redeemer. The problem with that translation is, first of all, what does that word redeem mean? Redeem is a funny word. So what does that word redeem mean? V'lo yamus harotzeach, and the murderer will not die, adamdo lifnei ha'edah la'mishpat, until he stands before the Eidah. The Eidah means the congregation, but here it refers to the Beis Din, the court, la'mishpat, for judgment. I see there's a hand up online. You have a question?
Yeah, I have a question. Does the Gemara or talk about somebody who's blamed for something that he actually didn't do? Like maybe someone accuses him or thinks he killed his brother or whatever, and he's running after him. He wants to kill him, in vengeance, but actually didn't do it. I would imagine he falls as, that's not negligent. He is blameless, but I'm guessing he would still run to this, this city of refuge.
Okay, so the Gemara talks about a person who is framed, which is really a separate discussion, but what you're bringing up is, as we're about to get into, the Goel, this relative who is out to kill the murderer, how does he, what if he's making a mistake? He's not a court, so we have to discuss exactly how that works. So let's hold that question, let's cover a little bit more ground. If the question still bothers you, so ask it a little bit later, but let's see how far we get over here first.
Okay.
So why is he escaping to the city of refuge, to the Eir Miklat? Because of the Goel. Now, the translation in English over here is the Avenger. The Avenger. Now, what does Goel mean? His full name is going to be Goel Hadam, which is the Avenger of Blood, or the Redeemer of Blood. Goel means to redeem. What does redeem mean anyway? So redeem really, literally, the term Goel in scripture, in Tanakh, would literally mean to, it could mean to exchange, but it usually has some connotation of lifting something up, of raising something higher, so that you're exchanging one thing for another in order to take that item and make it a loftier item, a better item. That's usually how we're waiting for Geula, to be redeemed by Mashiach. That's what Geula means. So what does that mean? It means that we're going to be taken out and put onto a higher status. So this Goel, this Avenger, he is coming to avenge the blood of his relative. That's what he's coming to do. So the term Goel means to redeem, but it really means to exchange. You caused the death of my relative, so I am going to cause your death. It is exchanging blood for blood. That's really what is being in, that's the intention of this term Goel over here. But it's a term that we would have expected, I think, a less lofty term for the Avenger. But I think we would have thought of something a little less. He's angry. The person is angry because this person was negligent and killed his relative. So the Torah uses a phrase that I think is loftier than we would have expected, to use the term Goel. Who is a Goel? Who enters that category? So the Rambam writes that a Goel is anybody that is in line for inheritance. So if a man is killed, his sons, who are the immediate inheritors, they would be the Goel, the Goalim. It could also be the daughters. A Goel could be female as well. We don't picture the female running after the murderer to kill him, but it could be female, it doesn't have to be male. And it could be a brother, it could be the deceased's father, it could be someone of the immediate relatives who is in line to inherit. Those are that would be the Goel or the Goalim. Pasuk Yud-Gimel verse 13. V'ha'arim asher titenu, the cities you will give, that are going to be these cities of refuge, sheish arei miklat tiana lachem. They will be six cities of refuge. The reason why it's phrased that way is to teach us that until all six were designated, none of them were effective. Even though Moshe Rabbeinu already designated three before he died, but the Jews had not yet conquered the rest of Israel, and therefore he could not designate the other three. Yehoshua did later on. Until Yehoshua designated the numbers 4, 5, and 6, the first three were ineffective. You need all six to be working simultaneously. Eis shloshe arim titnu me'ever la'yarden, three you put on the eastern bank of the Jordan River. Ve'is shlosh shaarim titnu be'aretz Kanaan, and three you put in the land of Canaan on the west, on the western side of the Jordan River. Arei miklat tiyena, they will be cities of refuge. For whom? Livnei Yisrael, they'll be for regular born Jews. Vilakir v'latoshav b'socham, and also for the convert. And even for the Toshav is the non-Jew who is careful to keep the seven mitzvos that he's supposed to keep, and he dwells in Israel. So the cities of refuge will be for them as well. Tiena sheish harim ha'ele lemiklat, the six cities will be for refuge. Lanus shama, to escape there, kol makei nefesh bishgaga, all who murder unintentionally. Yeah.
Two questions. What if there's no goel? Let's say it's someone who's has no family, or it's a tinoket or something like that, or okay. Care. So what happens then? And do we have records like that there was huge cities of refuge, or were, did they remain small?
Okay. Okay, two questions. One question is, what if there is no goel, particularly a convert? Convert doesn't have any relatives who are Jewish and has no goel. So if there is no goel, then there is none. The non-goel being present will only affect whether there is some fear that the murderer has to run to the city of refuge and remain there. The whether there is a goel or not, there is a commandment that he go to the city of refuge and remain there. He may decide not to keep it, which is, he's not doing a mitzvah that he's supposed to do. That's, which is the same consequence as anybody who decides not to do a mitzvah. But here the Torah puts an extra incentive in, which is that if he doesn't go, the goel is going to be on his case. So if there is no goel, then we just don't have that incentive. As far as the records of what this, how big the cities are, we know which cities they were. The in the Navi itself, in the Chumash, and in Yahushua, it actually tells us the names of the cities. Shechem is one of them. So we know the names of the cities. Now, the Gemara has rules for the size of the city. The Gemara says that the cities should not be small hamlets, because we want anybody who runs to one of these cities to feel safe. They're not going to feel safe if it's a little hamlet, because in that situation, who knows, the Goel might show up anyway and attack him with, and no one's going to know. We also don't want it to be a very, very large metropolis for the same reason, because if it's a large city, also no one's going to know. We want it to be a city that has some size to it, but not so big that people don't recognize a stranger. We want people to notice when someone shows up to town that doesn't belong here. So the Gemara has rules for how large we allow the city to become, and how small we allow the city to become. We can't control residents do, but when the city reaches a certain limit, Beis Din can say, okay, no more moving into Shechem for now, until people decide to move out. Or if it starts to get smaller, Beis Din can make incentives for Jews to move to Shechem. You know, cheap housing, whatever it is, right? But they can make it to entice people to move there, because we need it to be a larger city. So that is discussed. The Gemara raises the question that we have three cities on the east bank, on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and three cities on the western side of the Jordan River. But we only have 2.5 tribes on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and we have 9.5 tribes on the western side of the Jordan River. So you would think that you need more cities in Israel proper and fewer cities on the other side, because it's fewer amount of people. So why do you have the same amount of cities? The Gemara answers this question with a fascinating statement. The Gemara says, "Begilad shchichi rotzchim," that in Gilad was one of the areas on the eastern side of the Jordan River, in present-day Jordan, shchichi rotzchim, it was common to have murderers. That's what it says. The difficulty is that with the verse that the Gemara cites to prove that in Gilad it was common to have murderers is referring to premeditated murder. Evidently, in Gilad, there were more people who would murder. But premeditated murder is not a reason to run to a city of refuge. So even if there were more deliberate murders in Gilad, why would that warrant more cities of refuge? So the commentaries explain that in a culture where there is less emphasis on the importance of human life, and there are more people who murder in cold blood, there will also be more people who are negligent, even though they're not cold-blooded murderers, but there's a general culture that people's lives aren't that important. And therefore, just as there are more people who are going to be murdering on purpose, there will also be more people who won't fasten the axe handle properly, or similar types of things. And it's just in general, there's just a general lax in value of human life. So therefore, you'll have more people who need to be put to death for capital punishment for murder, but you'll also have more people who will in general be less careful, and there'll be more city of refuge situations. In our day and age, one has to ask the question, what happens if someone is a reckless driver, God forbid, and kills? They weren't trying to kill anybody. So, but that's negligence. Do they go to a city of refuge? That's another gray area case. Where does that fit? Right. So that's the kind of idea we're talking about. Once people are less, have less value for human life, then they're going to behave in a manner that will cause more negligence as well. Okay. Now I want to give you, before we read any further, I want to give you the formula for what happens. We're going to have more about this as we move on, but right now the Torah is going to segue for a brief amount of time on premeditated murder and then come back to the cities of refuge. So I just want to give you the general formula. If, God forbid, somebody commits a murder, the very first thing they do is they run to a city of refuge. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are. The first thing he does is he runs to a city of refuge. The closest one, he runs there. Before there's a court case, anything, he runs to the city of refuge. That's the first move. Once he gets there safely, and we assume he's going to get there safely because he's going to run right away, then Beis Din does its investigation, and they, under police escort, take him out of the city of refuge and bring him to court, try him in court, and arrive at one of the three categories that we mentioned. They may decide that this was premeditated murder, and you're not going back to that city of refuge, we're putting you to death. That might be the result of their court case. Or they might decide that this was blameless. He doesn't have to run to a city of refuge, he's perfectly fine. Or they may say that it actually is a case of negligence. He belongs in the city, in the Ir Miklat, and they will escort him back to the city, and that's where he will stay until the prescribed amount of time, which we'll see later on what that is. So the first step is run to the city, and then they will try him. The court case has to take place in the city where the murder took place, not in the city of refuge. So the court case takes place over there, and then whatever is decided is decided. The Goel Hadam, the avenger, the relative, he is going to be, we are presuming that he is going to look for opportunities to take revenge for what happened. The Torah presumes this to be the case. This has always intrigued me, that rather than the Torah saying to the relatives, okay, everybody, calm down, we don't know what happened, let's work it out, let's figure it out, rather than say that, the Torah just works with the presumption that human beings will be human beings, and people get very, very, very upset when their relative is, God forbid, killed, and therefore we work with that in the system. It's similar to what we had in yesterday's reading, in yesterday's parsha, with the Yefas Toar, where at war, the Torah allows certain under certain circumstances for a man to take a woman from the battlefield as a wife. That is the Gemara says, Dibra Torah keneged yetzer hara. The Torah says that we understand it in war, the way the adrenaline is flowing, it's very difficult for a person to be in full control, and therefore there is an exception to the normal morality that we expect of people. Here as well, the Torah expects that the relatives are not going to be able to be told, stay in control. That's something which you can't, it's too much to expect of people. There was a case where the person, their relative was murdered. The murderer was at least negligent, which means it was a preventable death, and they're not going to take that sitting down. And therefore, the Torah incorporates into the law this person running after the murderer to take revenge, rather than wag our finger at him and say, no, don't take revenge. The Torah expects that he will. And instead of prohibiting it, the Torah weaves it into the law itself. It's a fascinating thing the Torah does over here, that we weave that anger into the law itself. And this person is going to end up being essentially the police force that is going to ensure that the murderer run to the city of refuge and remain in the city of refuge. Yeah.
But let's say the court decides that he's innocent.
Right.
And he doesn't have to go to the city of refuge, but he sees the anger and
right.
the other people. I mean, it doesn't stop on
right.
just
so,
the court decision. Right.
Right. So what happens, right, what happens when the court decides that the person's innocent? So it seems to me that the way the Torah is handling it is, it's saying to the relative, you have every right to be angry. And until we resolve this case, go after him. Run after that murderer. You have every right to be angry. And that murderer, even if it was a blameless murder, the fact is, there's a human being who is now dead. Therefore, run. Get to that city of refuge. And this relative is going to be hot on your heels. Get in there, and we'll take it from there. But at least we're not saying to the relative, calm down. We're letting it play out. Now then we're going to try the case. Now you're right. If we determine that in fact he was blameless, then we're going to warn the relatives, because at that point, if they kill the murderer, they are murderers, and we will try them for murder. So at that point, we're going to say that you might be very upset, but this person is blameless. And if you attempt if you kill this person, we're going to catch you and kill you. Now,
I have a question.
Yes.
Two questions. So it sounds like let's take the victim's relative is running after the murderer, and the murderer has not yet gotten to the city of refuge, but he catches him and he kills him. So he hasn't been judged. We don't know what happened, but he kills him. The pursuer who kills, what happens to him?
If the pursuer kills him before he gets to the city of refuge, he is taking a very big chance, because we're still going to try the case, and if we determine that the murderer was blameless, then now the relative is going to be tried for murder.
Premeditated
murder, right.
They're going to try the case even though the guy's dead.
Yes, because we have to know whether the relative who killed him was justified for doing that.
Okay, well, let's say the guy, said, well, he wasn't justified, he was negligent. Are they going to kill the new murderer then, or what are they going to do?
If he was negligent, then we will not kill the new murderer, because the rule with someone who kills with negligence is he has to run to the city of refuge, and if he's not there, whether he hasn't gotten there yet or whether he comes out, the relative is allowed to kill him. We haven't gotten to that yet. We're about to get to it soon. About that.
Okay, one other question, I'll let you go. Let's say the city of refuge is across the Jordan. Can they cross the Jordan to go to the other city?
They can. They can cross. The question is, can they cross the Jordan and run to the other one? They can. They can go to anyone they want. However, it is prudent to go to the closest city. And we'll see the cities are interspersed evenly throughout Israel to make it accessible to everybody. So we'll see about that. Now, the Rambam writes that we do not want a culture of murder. And therefore, he writes that if someone technically is able to avoid the death penalty, but they clearly were behaving in a manner that was, that they were trying to murder somebody, that perhaps they caused the murder, but in an indirect way or something like that, the Rambam writes, the court should take that person and should make that person suffer greatly. He writes that the court should cause that person a lot of pain, should lock the person up for a long period of time. He writes all kinds of things that they should do to that person. We don't want a culture of murder. So even though we may have very specific rules for actually carrying out the death penalty, but the Rambam says when it comes to murder, it's unlike any other capital crime in the Torah. All other capital crimes in the Torah, if technically the person is to be put to death, we put them to death. If under a technicality a person can't be put to death, then we don't put them to death, then it's between them and God. But with murder, if the person gets out on a technicality, we make sure that the person suffers, because we got to make sure that murder is not something that is a general, something that people think they can get away with. There are categories where the person murdered, it was not fully intentional, but it was more than negligence. So it's one of those gray area cases we were talking about before, where the person, it was more than regular negligence, but not quite premeditated murder. The Rambam writes that in those sorts of situations, and again, it's hard to define exactly what the cases are, but in those sorts of situations, we will not put the person to death, but the person cannot, the city of refuge will not protect the person. And essentially, this person is now on the run for the rest of their lives. Meaning, the relative can hunt them down. We will not prevent the relative from hunting them down, but we will not carry out the capital punishment either, and no city of refuge will help. The person is going to live in constant fear the rest of their lives because of what they did. Again, that's not just pure negligence. That's where the person was pushing the envelope somewhat. Perhaps this case of intending to murder one person but murdering somebody else. Those sorts of cases, we're not dealing with a good person. We're dealing with a person who was pushing the envelope on murder. So they may end up in a category where they're not put to death by the court, but on the other hand, there's no place where they'll be safe. Yeah.
When you say intentional, is it only intentional to do harm or to do harm to a specific person? Like I could see someone planting a minefield. They know somebody's going to get hurt if they step on it, but they don't know exactly who.
Okay, good.
Is that still under intentional, or right. It has to be a specific person?
Okay, so the question is, does it have to be that intentional to kill a specific person, or what if it was, like you said, putting out a minefield and you don't know who's going to walk there? The Gemara speaks about throwing a dangerous object, we would say shooting a gun, into a crowd. Right? So what is that? How do we deal with that? He wasn't aiming necessarily for a specific person, but somebody got killed, right? So that may be a case. I don't know how we conclude in that case. That may be a case where we actually put the person to death, and it may be a case, like we just mentioned, where the person's not put to death, but at the same time, there's no place to run, no place to hide, right? They're going to be, they're going to be tracked down. They have to run the rest of their lives. Yeah.
Is there an excuse like act of passion in the Torah?
Okay, so the question is there an excuse act of passion in the Torah? The truth is that's really what the relative is over here. The relative who's running after him to kill him, that is act of passion. But okay. other than that, we don't really have a case of act of passion.
But if the relative were to kill, could he use that as an excuse? Would that
So the question is, if the relative would kill, is that an excuse? In the, it would only be an excuse under the circumstances where the Torah allows the relative to kill. But if he kills someone who doesn't deserve to be killed, he'll be tried for murder. So we are expected to not kill someone who is really truly innocent, even though we may be very, very upset.
So like in the case where the guy can't go to a city of refuge, he runs for the rest of the life, the redeemer, the relative, catches up with him and kills him in an act of passion or revenge, that would be okay?
That would be okay. That is exactly what we're saying over here, that in a case where there is no, where the Torah does not give the person a place to run, then the relative has the right to kill him. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do we say anything in Judaism about like a reason of insanity or because they didn't know the difference between what they were doing?
Okay, the question is reason of it. What about, is there an insanity plea, and what about ignorance? So ignorance is always a defense, although it's hard to prove innocence with murder. There would have to be some compelling evidence the person really did not know you're not allowed to murder. Most people know that. You don't have to be Jewish, you don't have to be religious. People know murder is a bad thing. So that's a difficult defense. But we do accept that defense. Insanity, in theory, we would accept that also, except I don't know what level of insanity you would need. Even in secular courts today, I'm not sure. I think that they have, I think they've kind of sharpened their definition of insanity since John Hinckley Jr. Right? I think that they've sharpened it a little bit of what you call insanity, you know, shooting a president, you know, like, I don't know exactly what, for instance, the Gemara says, no one sins unless they first get a ruach shtus. A ruach shtus means some level of insanity. Because if we were perfectly sane, and we knew why we're in this world, and that there's a God, we wouldn't sin. So in order to sin, a person has to kind of have a little bit of a suspension of reality. For any sin that we do. So, right, but yes, a person who is truly insane, clearly, obviously insane, that would be an excuse. Yeah, that would be a plea. Yeah. Okay. So let's read a little bit further over here. Pasuk Tezayin, verse 16. As I mentioned, we're now going to move to intentional murder. Vim bichli barzel hi kahu. If he struck him with an iron utensil, Vayamos, and he killed him, Rotseyahu, then he is a premeditated murderer, Mos Yumasa Rotseyach, he will be put to death. That he would not run to a city of refuge, he struck him with an iron object, and killed him, then he's killed. Vimbe Evan Yada Shayamus Bahikahu, or with a stone, utensil that fits in the hand, he struck him with that and killed him. Vayamos, he killed him. Rotseachu, he's a murderer. Mos Yumasa Rotseach, he'll be put to death. Obichli Eitz Yad Hashayamus Bohikahu, or with a wooden utensil that you can use to kill. He struck him. Vayamos, he killed him. Rotseachu, he is a murderer. Mos Yumas Harotseach, he will be put to death. So all these three cases are premeditated murder. Just a detail. In the first of those three verses, in 16, it says an iron utensil. It does not say an iron utensil that can be used for murder. When it mentions the stone utensil in 17 and the wooden utensil in 18, then it says I'm going to read the English here, by which one could die. A utensil by which one could die. The Gemara tells us that the Torah is making a distinction between metal and stone and wood. That stone and wood, those you have to assess the murder weapon and make sure that it was something that was able to kill. But with metal, you don't have to assess the weapon so much, meaning that when we're saying this person murdered on purpose, That's only if they used a weapon that is something that can cause murder. They used it in a way that could cause murder. And they struck the victim in a way that would normally cause murder. So, for example, a person took a stone, which could cause murder, and he threw it with force. That can cause murder. And he hit the victim on the head. That can cause murder. So that fulfills all three requirements. But if he took a pebble and he threw it and hit the person in the head, and a fluke happened and it killed him, that we would not call a capital crime because the pebble doesn't normally kill. Or if he would take that heavy stone and threw it with force, but hit the person on the foot, and a fluke happens and the person dies, again, we wouldn't call that a capital crime because it's not normal for a stone to kill if it hits on the foot. But with metal, if it penetrates the body, not if it strikes the body, but if it penetrates the body in any part of the body, even on the toe, and it kills, we will call that premeditated murder because we know this, that the likelihood of infection and inflammation is greater with metal than with stone or wood. And therefore, the Torah gives, there's less of, I don't want to use the word excuse, I want to use, how do we say it? There's,
less leeway.
Okay, less leeway with metal than with other materials. That's why it's worded this way. Yeah.
When we're talking Rabbi? Here, we're only talking physical murder and not like somebody who like they cut off a hand or something so they can't work or whatever. Like sometimes we've made references to other people.
Yeah. Okay, good question. So the question is, are we talking here about only physical murder? What about if it's indirect? The person cut off the other person's hand, now they can't work, and then they starve to death.
Or they castrate them so there's no children from
Right. So this is all only premeditated murder. There is indirect murder. Even indirect murder, the Gemara discusses what happens if a person, is out in the sun and another person ties them down over there and they die because of exposure. So that's sort of indirect, right? It was really the sun that killed them. Or what if a person, this is like, you know, from murder novels, mystery novels, what if they tie them down at low tide and then the tide comes in and they drown? Right, all these things, yeah, you can have various cases like that. So there is direct murder and indirect murder. Direct murder, of course, is capital punishment. Indirect murder, depending on how indirect it is, the person might avoid technical capital punishment. But again, the Rambam says, in that sort of situation, we're going to make the person miserable because clearly the person did something that was obviously to murder. Yes.
Rabbi,
yeah.
I'm wondering about something that's always bothered me is the story of Cain and Abel. So Cain does kill Abel, but then, God gives him a little sign on his forehead and he has to walk around with some guilt, but he doesn't get a punishment, really. I mean, outside of that. So,
right.
How did the rabbi explain Cain and Abel?
Yeah, so the question is, what about Cain and Abel? So there.
Hadn't been given yet.
Yeah, so he wasn't tried yet. He wasn't put to death. So there was what Dina just said is that the Torah wasn't yet given, so there was no commandment to not murder. But the truth is, the Gemara tells us that all seven mitzvahs were commanded to Adam, that he was warned of all seven, and one of them is murder. So that would therefore warrant being put to death. The difference is that there was no Beis Din, there was no court system. The one who tried that case was God himself. Now a court is unable to be forgiving. If a person does something and all the rules fit that the person now needs to be put to death, then that's what we have to do. We can't feel bad for the criminal. Because if we do that, then that destroys the entire court system. So if a person committed the crime, we have to carry out the punishment. But in the case of Cain and Hevel, there was no court system, because the only other people alive were his parents. So so therefore Hashem is the one who tried it, and Hashem has the right to obviously decide how he wants to do it. And there evidently Cain did some level of tshuva, some level of repentance, and therefore he was not put to death. That seems to be the most direct way to handle that question. Now I want to read one more verse over here. This is important. We're talking about premeditated murder. So Pasuk Yud Tes 19, Goel Hadam Hu Yamis Sarotzeach. Who carries out capital punishment? It is the relative, the avenger. Befigo Vohu Yamisenu, when he meets up with him, he will kill him. A person murdered on purpose, premeditated. So who puts that person to death? Well, if he escapes the court system, the avenger, the relative, can kill him. But even more than that, if the court finds him guilty, and now we're going to put him to death, who actually is the executioner? The relative. This is another example of where we acknowledge the relative's anger. We say, okay, this person killed your relative in cold blood. Here's the sword. You may carry out the punishment. That's how we do it. Now, if the relative refuses to do it, is too queasy to do it, there is no relative, then we'll do it, because there's capital punishment. And there is Basin does have an executioner, because there are other crimes for which there is capital punishment besides murder. Idolatry is capital punishment. There are other averos for which there's capital punishment. But in this case, the first choice of executioner is the Goel Hadam, is that relative. So we're acknowledging that, really, that passion. That's really what we're acknowledging. Yeah?
Are we talking hanging, stoning?
The punishment, the type of capital punishment, remember there are four capital punishments that the court uses. For murder, it's beheading. That's the one that is used for murder.
What happens if a cousin sees it happen and can get to the guy before he gets to the city of refuge? But he's not the brother who's going to be the inheritor.
Good. Yeah, so the question is, what if it's not the direct inheritor? It's the one past, that's a cousin, which is, so he's very, very upset, but he's not the direct inheritor. So it was not clear to me. It seems to me from the Rambam that he would not have the right to kill him. That's what it seems to me.
Even like if it was the brother's son, so it was a nephew.
Right, so I'm not sure how close do you get if it's a nephew. Right. There are very difficult cases. What happens if, God forbid, what happens if, God forbid, a father kills a son, or a son kills a father? So, what do you do then? The relative is the relative of both the victim and the murderer. Maybe you can have cases like that. So it gets complicated and it gets difficult. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a way to not have cruel and unusual way of killing? Does he have to do it in a certain way that it's swift or it's
so
torture?
That's a good question. The question is being asked is, If the relative catches up and is able and has the right to kill,
or if Basin says, okay,
yeah,
kill.
Well, if Basin says kill, then they do it in the prescribed way, which is beheading, which is a swift punishment. But you're asking if he catches up with him and it's outside of Basin, so he wants to kill him. What if he tortures him and then kills him? So he does not have the right to torture him. He has the right to kill him, but he has no right to deliberately cause him extra suffering. That's not within his purview, and we will try him for that. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. We have a few more minutes. Let's just finish up this part about the premeditated murder. So next time we'll come back to the negligence. Pasuk Chav, verse 20. Vim besin'a yadafenu. If he, literally it means to push him, push him. If he pushes him out of hatred, pushing him could be pushing him off of a building, right? But he kills him by pushing him out of hatred. O ishlich alav bitzdia, or he threw something heavy upon him to kill him, and he was hunting him, vayamos, and he was killed. All these are premeditated murder. Or with hatred, he struck him by hand. He punched him, but on purpose, with intent to kill. Vayamos, and he was killed. Then, the one who strikes, the murderer will be put to death. He is a murderer. Who will kill him? Again, Goel Hadam, Yamise Sarotseach Befigovo, it will be the Goel Hadam, the relative, who will put the murderer to death when he is able to catch up with him. What's the language they use here? When he encounters him. Okay. Right. So again, if it's in court, it's in court. If it's not in court, then it's not in court. But either way, the Goel Hadam becomes essentially the police force in this case. Not the police force in terms of determining what the law is, but in terms of enforcing the law, we use that, again, I like that word, we'll use that passion of the relative to enforce the law. That's what the Torah is saying over here. Okay, now we still have a lot more to cover because we have not yet really explained the specifics of unintentional murder and we haven't even said about going to the city of refuge. What if they walk out of the city of refuge when they're not supposed to? How long do they stay in the city of refuge? All those details we haven't yet covered. So
Kohen Gadol dies while the court case is going.
Right. The Kohen Gadol. We haven't mentioned the Kohen Gadol yet, but we're going to get to that soon.
Also, if you could mention if the only witness is the Redeemer.
Yeah.
Then how do you? What if the only? Because that's not a reliable witness.
Right.
Then, right.
Right. What if the only witness is the Redeemer? Right. You can't use him as a witness because he's a relative of the victim. Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so we'll cover this, Mr. Hashem. Next week we'll continue.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.